the cartoon is two people in heaven greeting this one guy coming to heaven, and the one guy coming to heaven has six or seven halos above his head. And the little cartoon says he had multiple personalities, but they were all good. So we're going to dive in, and I'm going to really, really apologize and ask to hold comments and questions, because I went over what I have left with Janine, and she and I agree we want to try to get it all to you. So last night, but we will end at 4, for sure.
And have time,
maybe.
To maybe. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so last night... I said something about the first step, and you all went, woof, right? Yeah. And you started writing stuff down. So I was like, oh, they like steps. So I want to share. I want to share 6 steps. I was going to give this at the end if there was time, but I want to give it to you now. So. These are steps for towards inner truth, is what I've called them. Number 1, take your thoughts captive with the butterfly net. That means be more aware of your inner dialogue. As you become aware of your inner dialogue, you listen for the burdens. So you listen for false guilt, false responsibility. So step number 2 is unburden. Unburden shame. That's the clearing out the clutter, cleaning out your closet. Step 3, identify your expectations. So your hopes, dreams, and wants that you have taken too far.
What do you mean by taken too far?
Turn it into an expectation. So I hoped it would be sunny this weekend. It's not. And so I wasn't expecting it. Therefore, I'm not devastated. But if I was expecting it to be sunny and it's not, then I feel a lot of remorse about it. It's what we call also taking it too far would be like a false expectation. I hope my husband has the house cleaned the way I asked him to have it cleaned before when I get back, but I'm not going to expect it, which means I'm not going to bark at him when it's not done. I might frown, be like, I understand, honey, you're busy, and move on. It's just a hope. We have expectations of God. So learning what do we expect of God, I'm trying to use this. No dialogue. All right.
Is this number 4?
Still number 3. Identifying expectations. We have expectations of God, parents, kids, our priest, our husbands, ourselves. We pick up false expectations from society, from our spouse, from friends, our boss. So that's just a little bit on expectations if we don't have time to get to it later. Number 4, distinguishing between wants and needs.
Americans?
Bingo. First world people. Number 5, grieving. And number 6, forgiving. And that's threefold. Forgive yourself, forgive God, and forgive others. Now, of course, God does not need our forgiveness, but we need to forgive him if we have a grudge. Okay, So, hopes, expectations, desires, disappointments. Bringing those into an understanding of what's the healthy balance, right? This is a phrase I keep using and I keep getting questions about. I love it. I love your questions, by the way, and your feedback. So hope is something like a dream, right? I hope that my kids grow up and become and stay in the Orthodox faith, right? That's a hope. But it's oftentimes not realized. And so we have to learn to grieve our unrealized hopes. There is such a thing as toxic hope. Toxic hope is a similar way of saying an unrelenting standard or an unreasonable expectation. But in our inner dialogue, it may not feel like an expectation. It might just feel like a hope. But it might be toxic to you. It might be toxic to the people around you. So I work with a lot of women whose husbands are not involved in church. And so they are constantly hoping that their husband is going to get involved in church or find Jesus or whatever it is. Right? And that's a good hope to have, of course, right? But it's toxic because it's getting in the way of them actually loving their husband. Any other thoughts about hopes? I could, again, do a whole half hour on hopes, but... Okay. Expectations. These reveal our sense of entitlement. They reveal our assumptions, our bias that we go into the world with. Expectations are oftentimes an unspoken contract, right? Some of you don't have to ask your husband to clean house. Maybe that's just unspoken. Somebody in here has a husband who cooks, right? It's an unspoken contract. It's an automatic. Those are normal expectations. But how do we adjust our expectations when they create conflict in relationships? Well, we have to take into consideration what is the other person asking, and then we have to consider how do we negotiate those expectations. And if your expectation feels like a demand, like it feels like, no, this must be how it is, perhaps because that's what Scripture says, and yet that's keeping you from being able to love your neighbor, then it's usually a good idea to consider reevaluating that expectation, even if it's what Scripture says. So, in our adjustment of expectations, it's a self-examination, right? It's a prayer that happens. We're not just doing this as a mental exercise. It's not something we just stay in our heads about. We take it to God to ask for clarity, to ask for clarification. All right, so coffee hour. Some parishes are structured in a way where it's an unspoken expectation that the wife of that parish, the clergy wife of that parish, is the one that's supposed to make the coffee, for example. Right? The one that's supposed to stick around and clean up after coffee hour. The one that's supposed to organize who's going to provide coffee hour refreshments. Right? So a new priest's wife comes in, guess what? She's got a full-time job and doesn't have time for that sort of thing. So then people are disappointed. And then she's disappointed that they're disappointed. Right? And then we have the cycle of false expectations being placed upon one another and the disappointment. Now, parishioners, for the most part, are not good at dealing with disappointment. Amen, right? So the more we deal with our own disappointments, the better we will tolerate their disappointment. Because they're gonna be disappointed with you. Period. If you try to avoid having your parishioners disappointed with you, good luck. You'll be spinning your wheels, you'll find burnout, you'll experience compassion fatigue. So again, the more disappointment you deal with your own disappointment, the better you'll be able to deal with their disappointment. Moving on, desires. We talked a little bit about this last night. No, we didn't. I'm sorry. We talked about needs. Suppressed desires, unrealized, so you don't feel... Or, I'm sorry. We tend to suppress our desires. We have unrealized desires, and therefore the disappointment. Our desires are like... Our desires can be needs or wants. Okay, so the word desire is misused. It's actually a really difficult word in our English language. Our Orthodox faith has made it a dirty word, so we have to be careful not to. It's like sin, right? Desires of the flesh, right? Right. Yes. Thank you. There's a sense of it's wrong to feel desire, right? But not all desire is wrong. If I can use Catherine's example earlier, if there's something her desires to sing again, right? That's a beautiful desire. And so when we suppress our desires, we suppress the good with the bad. So if I desire to run away to a monastery and leave my children at home because they're driving me crazy, right? Well, okay, what's the beauty in that desire? Oh, you want quiet time for your spirit, right? How it manifests may not be the best, but there's an essence in it. So every negative thought, every wrong desire has something good in it, has a gift in it. And that's why I talked so much last time about don't jump to, oh, I shouldn't think that. Oh, I shouldn't behave that way. Try to take a baby step of compassion and curiosity towards it so that you can understand what is that desire really about. Most clergy families who struggle, who have experienced infidelity of any kind, is because they have suppressed their desire and it has been twisted. Instead of transformed, it gets shoved out and it gets channeled, obviously, in a very destructive way. So this piece about desire is very important. Our asceticism says, have a desire, but have an open palm about it. Right? So if I desire something, and I'm like, oh gosh, I have to have, then that's when we know it's been twisted. But if we say, God, I have this desire, I'm holding it, I'm going to invite you to hold it with me, right? And let him know the desires of your heart. So you can have truth in your heart. Being honest with yourself. Not denying that you have a desire. Bringing it to confession. Bringing it into the light so that the light of Christ can heal it. So the next one I want to talk about is disappointments. We are not taught to suffer well. Mm-hmm. I believe life is a journey of learning how to grieve. And there's big G grieve, and then there's little G grieve. And little G grieve happens every day. I don't get to go explore in the woods because it's raining. There's a little grief there. Really little. A lot of other things that are much more important in my life today. But it's just an example. Right. Didn't get enough sleep last night. I did, and I slept great, thank God. But just another example. Just a little grief. Like, oh, I'm not going to have as much energy to socialize. I was really hoping to connect. Just a little grief. We have these little disappointments and these little griefs. Grieving. Grieving is a purge. If we neglect our grief work, we will accumulate toxin. Right? That wet sock that gets put in the closet turns to mold, mm-hmm. right? And it grows. That's not dealing with our little grief. You just shove it in the closet, that's trouble. So one of those steps was unburdening. I think step two, that grieving is how we unburden. Grieving takes us to the heart. Right? I mentally do a practice of turning over to God and then I take it back, as we've been discussing, that stays in the head. Grieving brings it to the heart. Grieving is a, oh God, I don't want to let this go, but I know I need to, and it's a wrestling with the Lord. That's our grieving. And in that, we dig that root, right? We get way down into the garden and we dig the root out. And that's the unburdening. That requires pain. As we talked earlier, most of us, well, human beings have an aversion towards pain. So I want to bring us to Mark 15. This sermon was given by my spiritual father, Father Basil, who's at Annunciation. They're retired, and so they just help out at Annunciation, Greek Orthodox Church in Muskegon. And when he gave the sermon, I just was, I just cried the whole time. And it's about, like, who... So in Mark 15, the myrrh-bearing women go to the grave, and they find Christ is not there, and they're devastated, right? So the three stones, like the stone that is on that grave, represents three obstacles in our lives. Obstacles of people around us, i.e. parishioners. Difficult circumstances, loss of a loved one, life circumstances. And third, struggle in your heart. We may have our desires fulfilled, but they may be empty desires. So the myrrh-bearing women who came to the tomb of Christ, they were first confused and disoriented. Right? They weren't filled with some spiritual hope. Oh, it's all going to work out to be okay. Right? No. They were devastated. And then, second, they mourned. They grieved. And third, they didn't stay stuck in their grief. Right? They did not stay stuck in that grief. If you find you're getting stuck in your grief, ask for help. And remember the rule of integrity. Don't ask for help until we're prepared to be told no. It's easy to get stuck in our grief if it's devastating. We all need help. We all need a companion. One of the ways to make sure you don't stay stuck in your grief, or another way of saying this, making an idol out of your feelings, right? Wallowing, I think, is another word that we use when we've been stuck in an emotion and can't find Christ in it. Is meaning-making. Meaning-making can be a lifeline. So how do you make meaning out of your losses? How do you make meaning out of the bad things that have happened to you or to your loved ones? When the women came to the tomb, they experienced an unfulfilled hope. They thought that Jesus was going to be there. The empty tomb can represent all of our unfulfilled hopes, our shattered dreams, and our unrealized desires. Imagine how disappointed they must have felt. Little did they know that the path to the risen Christ was through the dark tomb. So there are two ways, do I need to slow down? There are two ways we use what I use to call fig leaves, right? Fig leaves from Genesis are false ways in which we hide ourselves from God. There's two types of fig leaves we use most to deal with disappointment in order to avoid the pain, because sometimes the pain is just too painful. We either, one, tell ourselves that it's easier not to want, Or number two, we tell ourselves, don't be selfish. If we don't have truth in our inward parts, again, reflecting on last night, if we don't own our desires, honestly, then we walk through life limping. We're not our fullest self. So part of that being true to your inward self and being honest before God is about accepting disappointments. Like, admitting, I'm disappointed. Instead of just resigning to, woe is me, this is life. I'm meant to bear a cross, this is my cross. Sounds real spiritual, but it's missing something. Acceptance involves grieving. Resignation is a passive response.
Do you mean that admitting your disappointment is active?
Yes. Admitting your disappointment is active. Yes.
Repeat what the passive was.
Acceptance involves grieving, and resignation is a passive response. In other words, you guys heard the phrase victim mentality or martyr complex, right? That's resignation. If someone is constantly bemoaning, woe is me, life is hard, in a way that you can tell they're not grieving, they're just sulking, or you yourself, you're not grieving, you're just sulking, that's resignation. Acceptance is heartfelt grief, lamenting. Lamenting and sulking are very different. They're very similar, but they're very different. So this expectation, disappointment, grief cycle, right? Expectation, disappointment, and grief. It's a cycle. And anger and anxiety are part of that cycle. Okay? So this is not disconnected from all of the stuff we've been talking about. Expectations lead to disappointment, which leads to grieving, ideally. And so in order to reduce disappointment and grieving, we adjust our expectations. So the work is in adjusting the expectations. And the irony is that in order to adjust the expectations, we have to face our disappointments and we have to grieve. Yeah, one of those.
That sounds like it takes work.
A lot of work. And courage, which again is why we have to find that space to plug into Christ and let Him be our source and our strength. So now I want to talk about forgiveness. Essentially, we've been talking about forgiveness. So, disappointed in yourself, what do you do? What's your first knee-jerk reaction when you're disappointed in yourself? Mm-hmm. That inner critic says, oh, you screwed up again. Weather? Yeah. Yeah, you're bad.
Yeah. What's Sulking. Wrong with you?
What's wrong with you? Right, this choir of negativity. So if you adjust what you expect from yourself, perhaps you won't be so disappointed with yourself. Now who inside you, like what aspect of you holds those high standards? We've already talked about the moralizer as one. I think we talked about this last night, the interjects we get from other people. Other people put expectations on us. I've worked with people who their mother and father are long gone, but they still hear that you must do this. This is how you must behave, right? Well, are those expectations they still need to carry around?
No.
And I'm talking about unrelenting standards. You must have your house perfectly clean before you have company. Right? Unnecessary expectations. Now, when we talk about disappointment, when we have genuinely wronged another person, right, that gets more complicated. It's trickier because I'm not wanting to adjust my expectation to treat people well. I don't want to adjust that expectation. My Savior doesn't want me to adjust that expectation. But what Christ, how he informs what I do in response to not meeting that expectation of others as well, that's where he models compassion and mercy for us. And so that's where I can't bring compassion and mercy to when I fail as a wife and fail as a clergy wife, etc., or fail as a mother, right? Then that's where self-forgiveness comes in.
Can you clarify again? I'm not sure I caught what you said.
You mean from
this last part that you just said?
Self-accept forgiveness?
Yeah.
I have high expectations of myself, and I disappoint myself, and I'm not loving others well.
Okay. It's your expectation that you're not loving, I mean, that isn't fulfilled, not that you haven't loved others well.
No, I'm talking about, like, I genuinely screwed up.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, I said I wouldn't want to adjust that expectation. Right? And I want to keep loving others well.
Because you want to
keep
people
well. Okay. Yeah.
It sounds the opposite.
Yeah, that's what I think.
It sounded like you were saying, it's okay not to love other people.
Thank you.
I was confused.
Thank you. I'm so sorry. Yeah. So I don't want to adjust that expectation. I want to continue to love others well. But I'm going to fail. And so where Christ informs me in this is that I bring compassion and mercy to that failure instead of that self-condemnation, which takes me into that disappointment cycle. Right? So this is about having a healthy expectation and dealing with false disappointment. False guilt is another way to think about it.
It is a false guilt if you treated somebody wrong. I mean, you should feel guilty about that.
Right, it's false. Toxic guilt is maybe better when it starts to turn nasty inside. I talked a lot about that last night.
How is this for an example? So, my husband...
I'm recording. Just so you know.
Just a reminder.
Okay.
So my husband had been laid off from his job, and he was in the process of looking and trying to find, but he wanted to get rid of the email on his phone from his old job. And he asked me how to do it, because he's technologically challenged. So I did. In the process, I lost all his contacts.
Mm-hmm.
So a week later, he was asking something, and within that, he made some comment like, because all my contacts were lost. I had such toxic guilt over the fact that it was my fault that he lost all of his contacts that I assumed that he was beating me up still about losing his contacts. When he made that comment, I got snarky and I bit right back at him, and it created this.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
That's a good example of an external and internal process.
Mm-hmm. But I couldn't forgive myself.
Yes.
I was beating myself up for the honest mistake that I made.
And that's a little different.
But then I treated him badly because of my...
Yes. Right. And that is a little different because that was an honest mistake. Right. And I mean, anytime we sin, it's an honest mistake, even if it's a sin. Right. So there's that sense of I'm impatient, I'm unkind, I'm unloving to another. Maybe on a regular basis, right, consistently in that way, then I'm feeling guilt, which is appropriate, right, because in that hopefully takes me to the foot of the cross, right? But if it doesn't, and if I don't feel resolve in confession or in my prayer life, then that's a good indicator it's toxic guilt or false guilt. When we keep replaying the record, when we ruminate on it, and we keep beating ourselves up and saying things like, well, there you go again. Can't believe you did it again. When are you going to learn? Right? That's when it's no longer helpful. It's no longer edifying. And it's really no longer connected to Christ. He's not beating us up. He wants us to experience the compassion he has for us. Okay, time check.
3:30.
Okay. So that's self-script forgiveness. I'm not going to cover the other, forgiving others and forgiving God. I think we get enough of that in our church culture that is awesome. I think that it's self-forgiveness where we secretly struggle. Right. So, I'm going to move on to the two fig leaves. Anybody remember what they were?
Tell ourselves,
use your mouth to one, tell others, don't tell yourself, don't be selfish. Don't tell ourselves, don't be selfish.
Okay, don't be selfish. Alright, if I tell myself, don't be selfish, then I will most likely confuse healthy self-love with selfishness and therefore end up not loving myself well. And if I don't love myself well, I'm not going to have a whole lot of love to give other people. So, Mark 12:34 is the verse that says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, your whole being. Love your neighbor as yourself. Our culture is very egocentric. I'm guessing Christ's culture was rather the same. It's pretty universal in our human condition. But loving our neighbor as ourself goes back to that prioritizing, right? So I sit with Christ, I love myself by taking that time away from serving and sitting at the foot of Christ, right? That's healthy self-love. The burdened helper, like those little pictures that we had here, right? Those are examples when we compulsively help. When a parishioner walks up to us and says, I'm really struggling with such and such thing, and you actually have a prior obligation to help someone else or to be at home for your husband after church, and you say, you know what, let's go get coffee, right? That's an example of where the priorities are out of order. We have to discern, because the need is always going to be there. We're going to be constantly pulled at for what people need. And so I believe it takes quite a bit of discernment, quite a bit of, we can't do it all in our own head, on learning how to know when to say no and when to say yes. But I want to say this. Anytime you say yes to something, you are saying no to something else. Because you have a limited amount of time and energy in every day. So you're choosing. You may not be saying the words no, but you are saying no. So when you say yes, make sure you want to say yes. Make sure you feel called to say yes. Because perhaps you're neglecting something that is of higher priority. Some ways to say no without saying no. I can't remember if this is in your handout. It's not, this is not in your handout.
Oh,
darn.
You got it.
I
said
nice.
Oh, different languages. Yes.
I said quality.
Not now. Someone asks you to have dinner and your month is full. Not now. Maybe later. Right, these are ways to say no without saying no. The word no is hard to get out of our mouth. One main reason is because the other person receiving the no, we anticipate their feelings are going to be hurt. This anticipation is what makes us all so loving and caring. Right? We anticipate need sometimes before it's even asked of us. This is called the hurt of a servant. I talked yesterday about the personality profile of clergy wives. This is part of this. So within ourselves, when we know, if we know, like, okay, I'm going to anticipate need. This is my nature. Then you can learn how to not dive into something before you've really thought it through. So being able to say, not now, maybe later, and can I get back to you on that? That's one of my favorites.
Doesn't that mean you have to say no later?
It might not. So, for example, we just got to where we are 3.5 months ago, and we've been inundated with these lovely, warm, welcoming invitations, and I'm having to say not now. Mm-hmm. But I have all intentions to hopefully say yes later. So that's just an example of how that works. And this goes back to earlier, anticipating need and anticipating like someone's feelings getting hurt. If you work with your own disappointments, it's easier to tolerate it when other people are disappointed with you. So a lot of times we say yes compulsively, we compulsively help, or we compulsively give advice because we don't want someone else to feel disappointment because we cannot handle our own sense of disappointment. So rescuing complex is another word for it. So if you say yes when you need to say no, then you won't be freed up to say yes later. Perhaps there's a calling God has for you, and you don't know about it yet, and you say yes to something out of a compulsion, and then your time and energy is tied up to where you can't say yes to this other thing that comes later. And so trusting that if your intuition is saying, this is not how my time and energy is, I'm not feeling called to this, trust that. One of the first steps to learning the nuances of that discernment is prioritizing. Now, we have basic needs. Food, oxygen, water, sleep. Okay? So by prioritizing our basic needs, then we build on that. Right? We build on it because, okay, basic needs are met. And I am able, therefore, to say yes because my basic needs are met. I can say yes to the new thing introducing itself in my life so that I can say yes to the next new thing. If there's room, when I've already filled my time and taken my energy towards the basic needs. Otherwise, it's not sustainable. So, I would like for you guys to make your to-be list now. Take 30 seconds. So it's going to be a quick write. 30 seconds to write down ways in which you can rest, ways in which you can just be. Alright, so then you need some examples. Exercise, painting an egg, like we talked about earlier.
Oh, that's true.
Fly a kite, go to the park. Meditate. Breathe. Put a puzzle together. journal.
Make you a full journal.
Make lists. Take your vitamins. Play. Get a massage. Volunteer. Maybe, you know, as clergy wives, we give so much time and energy and we volunteer in so many ways, but maybe there's something in your life that you really feel passionate about that's not an outlet through the church. Maybe volunteering is life-giving for you in that way. This is about finding what's life-giving and what's life-taking and doing more of what's life-giving. So eating too much chocolate is life-taking. Eating more foods from the earth is life-giving. So if I focus on, okay, I need to stop eating so much chocolate or fried foods or whatever, is life-taking. And then I'm not putting that energy towards what's life-giving. So I'm talking about turning away from trying to stop behavior and turn toward creating a new habit. So focusing on what's life-giving and doing more of what's life-giving instead of getting so hung up on stopping certain things.
How was the end? I think you should email that to us once a week. 3:40.
All right, now I want you to make another list. This list is what gets in the way of you saying no.
I like the reaction.
I'm going to give you three examples just to start you off. One thing that might get in the way of you saying no is that you second guess yourself. Am I being selfish? Two, will other people think I'm being selfish? Three, if I don't say yes, then who on earth is going to do it? Mm-hmm. Say your complex. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you a minute and a half on this one.
Could you repeat what that list is? I'm sorry.
Second guessing yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry, the title of like what we're doing.
Things
I'm that far
back. Get in the way of you saying no.
Okay, thank you.
Or not now.
So basically, I just wrote down everything you said.
That's okay. You can cheat.
I'm perceived as being selfish.
So. I'm going to focus on number three because I've talked about the first two quite a bit. Number three was the one that said, if I don't do it, who will? This is where embracing your limitations, accepting your weaknesses, becomes a gift. For some people, limitations might mean, like, oh, they have a poor work ethic, or wow, how weak of them. A deficit in willpower, right? Willpower is not salvation. If someone else says no, honor it, because you want your no to be honored. And then give other people the benefit of the doubt. So when you go to say no, and you feel that muzzle that says, what if I don't do it, who will? Right? Believe in others. Trust that someone else is going to step in. And if someone else doesn't step in and suffering happens, thanks be to God. So, our fiery furnace is not just our own pain, it's having to watch other people suffer too. And as clergy wives, we watch it more than most. The more we deal with our own suffering, the more we can tolerate other people's suffering. And again, with Christ. You know, I talked so much last night about bringing Christ into your painful memories and grieving well, grieving in a way that honors God, right? That might mean you have to stay in bed an entire day and be completely useless to the world. That might be the most glorifying thing you can do for God, is let yourself grieve truly, and just collapse into his arms.
Which way do I go?
To answer one of the questions on the index cards on this note, healthy contemplation of grief is bringing Christ into the painful memory. And so therefore, when you have a temptation to dwell on that painful memory, Christ is part of it, so it becomes a prayer. That's the effort. That's why I had you write some prayers last night. So, you know, worry and anxiety, one of the things that I found useful to do with it, the ruminating and the busy mind that we've been talking about, is to turn it to prayer. I'll catch myself, I'll be like ruminating on something, usually when I'm in the shower or doing dishes, you know, some sort of like routine thing. I'll be like, oh, I need to pray about that. Right, so let your worry take you, let the energy of that worry propel you towards prayer instead of that self-condemnation of, there I go worrying again, look at me, I took it back from God. There's no reason to beat yourself up about it. Okay, I digress a little, sorry. So, back to honoring your limitations. If you know what you are capable of, in other words, if you know your strengths and you know your weaknesses, and you become confident in those strengths and weaknesses, then it's easier to have clarity to say, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that. Or say, yes, I would love to do that. I have the gifts to be able to say yes to that. Or no, I'm so sorry, no, I'm not equipped for that particular service. I'm not equipped for that particular need. But let me see if I can help you find someone. Right? So you can say it's helpful, you just might not be the spokesperson for it. So knowing or finding where your place of service is in parish life. And it's different for every clergy wife. Mm-hmm. And that's what I love. Oh my gosh, I've never been in a community, a clergy wife gathering, where that's not understood. Like everyone I've been to, it is understood. We are diverse in our gifts and diverse in our personalities. And one clergy wife, her life is going to look completely different to another. And that all be to the glory of God. So we cannot model our clergy wife role after another clergy wife. It won't work. Some of you might do this. Some people are really good with card sending. And there's a clergy wife I met recently, and she said these words, and it just my knee-jerk reaction was, oh my gosh, am I supposed to be doing that? And she said, oh, did you hear that so-and-so's father died? I haven't gotten my card off yet. And I was just like, oh, yeah, that's not going to happen. I just moved. And that's not my thing. Like, that's not my gifting. But God bless her that that is her thing, right? And she can do that and minister to people in that way, and it's beautiful. So knowing where your place of service is in parish life, God's given you each unique strengths, unique gifts. And if you don't use them, nobody else can. If you don't use your unique gifts, nobody else can. And the world is not a better place for it. Time?
3:50.
Okay. Thoughts and questions? I'll be a few minutes for that. I did have one question someone wrote that I really liked, and it's about balancing our negative feelings and affirming our negative feelings. I'm sorry, I just answered that. Yes. How do we serve with integrity? How do we grieve with integrity? And what that means to me is that, like Paul talks about, I can do all this stuff, right? I can be spiritual. I can make sure I keep my prayer rule. I can give to others and give time. But if I don't do it with a spirit of peace, it's a clashing cymbal. Right? It's a bunch of clank in God's ears. Because it's not putting our relationship with Him first. So it goes back to that prioritizing our time with the Lord and that relationship with Him. Sin isn't breaking a rule. In our culture of rules, we forget that sin is about a broken relationship. In marriage and family therapy lingo, It's a rupture in the relationship when we sin. And so our efforts are about repairing the relationship.